You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
You've got it tuned to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, broadcasting from the unceded and ancestral territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. What you're about to hear is a special presentation of intersectionality, feminism, and power, writers who define our times. A panel conversation produced by Literation in Vancouver as part of their 2021 Asian Heritage Month programming. Inequality is not created equal, the civil rights activist and scholar Kimberly Crenshaw once said. Experiences of racial inequality intersect at gender, class, and sexuality, and as such, these identity markers do not exist independently of each other, but rather inform each other. This intergenerational and multi-genre panel of writers will share their insights and experiences of how their personal journeys as writers have influenced their craft and provided meaning on how and why to tell their stories. This conversation features panelists Grace Iko Thompson, Larissa Lai, and Sarah Suk, and is moderated by Sharanjit Kaur Sandra. Enjoy.
And we're live. Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening from wherever you are joining us today. Welcome to the 9th Annual Literation Writers Festival. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Alan Cho. I'm the Festival Director of Literation. It's wonderful to share with you this event, which is a community building initiative of the Asian Canadian Writers Workshop. It's been a tragically difficult year for all of us. Not only have we been mired in a global pandemic, but we've also seen racism on the rise against Blacks, Indigenous, and people of color. Not just in North America, but across the world, anti-Asian racism and its gender-based violence is on the rise. Incredibly, 717% rise. An increase in anti-Asian hate crimes in Vancouver alone is just shocking. For that reason, global Asian as a theme is a paradigm of Asian Canadian experience. It's intercultural, intergenerational, and international. The experiences we face in Canada is not limited to our borders here. It's interconnected globally across the world. Our festival this year features writers in Canada, United States, and Asia. And as you'll find out, the experiences of these writers of Asian heritage share remarkable similarities of resilience. I want to thank you to our partners and sponsors who make our festival possible. BC Arts Council, BCA Sunwa, Iron Dog Books, Pacific Canada Heritage Center, Museum of Migration, PCHC, Rice Paper Magazine, Chinatown Youth Collaborative, and our wonderful team of volunteers, including Sophie Monk, our festival coordinator, who make this festival possible. And thank you to our audiences, for writers, students, teachers, who are joining us virtually from across the world today. Our festival founder, Jim Wan Chu, envisioned a literary event that would one day touch the world across time zones and geographies. In 2017, we created the Jim Wan Chu Emerging Writers Award to help create the next generation of Asian Canadian writers. We renamed the Emerging Writers Award after Jim. So without further ado, we have a video, and I'll hand it over to Jim to share with us that vision.
About 10 years ago, we created what we call the Emerging Writer Award. And at that time, there wasn't a lot of writers getting published, Asian writers getting published. And every season, there was a fall season, a spring season, we thought, and we would look, anticipate to see if there was an Asian writer at all. And we'd cheer if there was one or maybe two. And so one of our directors said, Jim, at least let's try to make at least try to guarantee one writer a year. So that's when we created the Emerging Writer Award. Emerging Writer Award is unique because it was a solution to a problem. It was not to give an award for somebody who published a book and that they're the best one published. We were using it as a vehicle to attract manuscripts. And so the best manuscript is the one that we choose. We give it a name, we give it the award, and help them get a jump start on their writing career. However, the other ones are mature and reasonably good, we will work with them also to try to get them published, because our main aim is to get as many people published as possible. So sometimes you can't leave things a chance. You have to find a way to do that. So we're now looking at the new generation. What are the new generation of Asian Canadians writing? And that's why we started the literation, the festival. Because up to that point, you know, you go to the Vancouver Writers Festival and you're seeing the token Asian. And basically it's fun, but it's not really a lot. Now we can come together as a community, read about ourselves, talk about ourselves, and actually learn and appreciate our own writing. And I think that that's one way we do it, because the reason why we create the Asian Canadian Writers Workshop in the first place, right from the very beginning, was that we were trying to create new writers. And so new writing was so important to us. That was still the mantra. You know, we do the Writers Festival and we're bringing in established writers, and we're having workshops to teach writers, teach people to learn to write, to inspire them, give them an opportunity.
Wonderful. Thanks. Next, I'd like to introduce Marlene Enns, who is the wife to the late Jimong Chu. And Marlene is also the chair of the awards jury, the Jimong Chu Emerging Writers Award. Now, the winners of this award have included the likes of Madeline Tien, Rita Wong, Catherine Hernandez, Phil Quinn, Jamie Liu, just to name a few. So this award has been a huge stepping stone to many writers. So I pass it over to you, Marlene.
Thanks, Elm. Well, I'm proud to be one of the judges for the Jimong Chu Emerging Writers Award, along with Mr. Edwin Lee, who's the author of Some Young Guys, and Dr. Trevor Carolyn, who is an author, a teacher, a musician, an art administrator, an advocate. Thanks to COVID, we received the first 25 pages of 11 submissions, which was awesome. And we were tasked to read them and to choose three full manuscripts. And we couldn't. We just couldn't. The stories were so good and so varied, we requested six full manuscripts. And we read about the effects of earthquakes and tsunamis in Japan, the heartbreak of Filipino women leaving their own children, coming to Canada to care for other people's children, a North Korean intelligence agent on the run, a family immigrating to Canada and the parents being forced to return home, leaving the children alone in Canada, a divorced woman who makes egg rolls for a living and is obsessed with kickboxing, and a complicated love between the son of an exiled Iranian professor and a Taiwanese woman spread over many years and countries. So you can see how difficult it was for us. But we did have to choose a final short list of three, and in no particular order. Sticky Rice and Grilled Cheese by Wiley Wei Chin Ho. Reunification Stories for Caregivers and the Ones Who Love Them by Jenny Lee Austria. And Oxford Soju Club by Jinwoo Park. It was a wonderful task.
Wonderful. Thank you, Marlene. The winner will be announced at the Word Vancouver Festival. We're doing this year because of the great amount of talented and creative manuscripts. We're doing a two-stage process. So the winner will be announced at the Word Vancouver Festival. But we have the shortlist, and that's a really wonderful list that we have there. So congratulations to our shortlist. Now, before I hand it over to our moderator for today, I want to introduce her to everyone. Sharanjit Kaur Sandra is a PhD candidate in the Department of History at UBC. She's co-curator of exhibits at the Sikh Heritage Museum, coordinator at the South Asian Studies Institute, and sessional history instructor at the University of the Fraser Valley. As well, she is the co-chair of the University of Fraser Valley's Race and Anti-Racism Network. Sharn is a past BC Museums Association Council member and is currently a director with the Pacific Canada Heritage Centre Museum of Migration, PCHC. Research interests involve looking at museums, critical race theory and effect, Sikh migration in 20th century British Columbia, and interracial solidarities as a movement towards anti-racism. So without further ado, I'd like to pass the stage over to you, Sharn.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Alan. So I'd like to acknowledge that I'm speaking from the unceded territories of the Stalo people, the people of the river. Thank you so much for the invitation from the Litter Asian organizers. You've all done such an amazing and incredible job of organizing this panel for today, and I'm honored to be a part of this conversation on a very apt theme of intersectionality, feminism, and power. What an incredible theme to explore the ways in which literature can be a force for change, and literature as well that is intersectional, feminist, and empowers. I'll begin by introducing our panelists for today, and then I have three questions for each of the authors. I'd like to keep the questions minimal to allow as much time as possible for the Q&A, which is the audience's chance to engage and ask in a feeling of community, or in Punjabi, we would say a collective sangat, despite the remote nature of the event. So I do encourage the attendees today to feel free to ask questions in the Q&A chat box as our authors are giving answers. And I'll do my very best to make sure that every question is answered depending on the time. So our writers in today's panel are Grace Aiko Thompson, Sarah Suk, and Larissa Lai. Grace Aiko Thompson is a second generation Japanese Canadian who with her parents and siblings lived in Paraguay, or, and correct me if I say this wrong, Powell Street downtown east side in Vancouver until 1942, when they were sent to the internment site of Minto Mines, BC, then in 1945, rural Manitoba. After restrictions were lifted, they resettled in the city of Winnipeg in 1950. Grace's education focused on her need to overcome memories of racism and identity issues through investigation of her cultural roots and through art. She graduated from the University of Manitoba and the University of Leeds, and as a curator of various art galleries from 1983 to 1998, she concentrated on cross-cultural issues as well as women's issues. In 2000, as director curator, she launched the Japanese Canadian National Museum. She was president of the National Association of Japanese Canadians in 2008 and served on the National Executive Board from 2005 to 2010. She's mother to two sons and a grandmother to five grandchildren, and currently participates in various downtown Eastside activities and issues. Welcome, Grace. Our second author is Sarah Suk. Sarah lives in Vancouver, Canada, where she writes stories and admires mountains. Sarah graduated from UBC with a major in English literature and a minor in creative writing. When she's not writing, you can find her hanging out by the water, taking film photos, or eating a bowl of bingsu. Made in Korea is her first novel. You can visit Sarah online at sarahsuk.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Sarah Eileen Suk. Welcome, Sarah. Our third author is Larissa Lai. Larissa has authored three novels, The Tiger Flew, Saltfish Girl, and When Fox is a Thousand, two poetry collections, Sybil and Rest with Rita Wong and Automaton Biographies, a chapbook, Eggs in the Basement, and a critical book, Slanting Eye, Imagining We, Asian Canadian literary production in the 1980s and 1990s. A recipient of the Astria Foundation Emerging Writers Award, she's been a finalist for the Books in Canada First Novel Award, the Tip Tree Award, the Sunburst Award, the City of Calgary W.O. Mitchell Award, the B.P. Nickel Chapbook Award, the Dorothy Livesay Prize, and the ACQL Gabrielle Roy Prize for Literary Criticism. Phew. Larissa has been writer in residence at the University of Calgary, the University of Guelph, and at Simon Fraser University, as well as guest professor at the University of Augsburg. At UBC, she served as assistant professor of Canadian literature for 7 years before relocating to the University of Calgary, where she is currently associate professor and Canada Research Chair in the Department of English. There, she directs the Insurgent Architects House for Creative Writing. Welcome to these amazing panelists, and I look forward to the discussion. I'm going to dive right in into my first question. And maybe, Larissa, if I can ask you to start the conversation with the first question. So my question is, can you each address how much more meaning and purpose your publications have had in light of the rise in anti-Asian hate and racism that we've been seeing all across North America? So how have your publications have more meaning and purpose in light of this? And feel free to plug your novels' names and your books' names. You must do that. So Larissa, I'll start with you.
All right. Thank you, Sharon. Thank you. It's an important and necessary question in this particular moment, for sure. The first thing your question makes me think of, you know, is that photo of Woody Guthrie with the sticker on it that says, "This machine kills fascists." Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, you know, we might think of our literature as also doing that, as mm-hmm. having, wouldn't that be great if it had that power to take down the haters? For sure, you know, I'm thinking about all of the terrible attacks that have been exercised against Asians, especially, you know, in Vancouver, where we're virtually meeting today, but across Turtle Island, and particularly those terrible shootings in Atlanta last month, just so incredibly devastating. I think there's a long history in Western culture, you know, in Western literatures, in Western media, of figuring Asians as inhuman. And I think that part of what makes that kind of violence possible is that imagination of us in the contemporary popular imagination. So, you know, I think about all those Vietnam War movies, right, that were so popular when I was a kid, or Dr. Fu Manchu, or thinking about that figure, the character that Mickey Rooney plays in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Like, there's so much of it that's just sort of out there. And I think, you know, the accumulation of it is really damaging. And so if I think there's something, you know, not just my work, but I mean that, you know, Grace's work, Sarah's work, the work of, you know, so many of the people who were named at the start of this event, who, you know, were had the Jim Wong Chu Asian Canadian Writers Award, people like Rhea Wong, other writers, Lydia Kwa, Hiromi Goto, Carrie Ann Leung, Catherine Hernandez. There's so many of us, I think, who, you know, in various ways have been part of this project to create a broad literature for all of us and for, you know, a more general audience as well, that makes complex representations of Asian people. So whether they're figured in poems or their characters in novels or short stories or whatever, I think just, you know, the doing the work that shows our lives as complex, as interesting, as messy, and shows us at the center of it. So in other words, it shows our humanity, is the work that will make a difference. Mine does it, but so does everybody else's. So, you know, I do think of it, you know, largely as a collective project. And the other thing I guess I would say in closing, that it's also really important for our stories and our poetry to be showing the relationships with other BIPOC peoples, with Black folks, with Indigenous people, that those relationships are always also really important, and that it's important that they not be kind of constantly triangulated through whiteness. I think that those are stories that are profoundly missing still on our, you know, in our literary culture. And I hope that some of the work I do does a little something to remedy that, but I think we have a long way to go.
Great, thank you, Larissa. Grace, if I can ask you the same question, I'll repeat the question again. Can you address how much more meaning and purpose your publication has in light of the rise in anti-Asian hate and racism?
I would like to, first of all, apologize that I am not a writer per se, and I really appreciate that I'm part of this group being invited. For me, the reason for my writing was not about writing per se, but because of my history. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to leave this history to my sons, who didn't experience what I experienced, in growing up in British Columbia in a racist society before, you know, through almost throughout my childhood into my adulthood. So for me, the importance of the book was to share. And I was very lucky when Caitlin Press decided to publish it, because it then became available to other people that food. You know, the thing is, my history is pretty well dismissed. We never hear about it anymore. But with the rise of racism right now, I'm reliving it. As a matter of fact, I was recently at Gary Park in Stevenson, or last year this would be, and a man yelled at me saying that go back where you came from, which is what is being said by racists all over the place. Mm-hmm. And that made me realize that I knew that it was existing. I knew that it was hidden all this time, that there were people who were still racist. But then, you know, through the years, I came to realize that racism is not my problem. It's a problem that we all have to face, regardless of our of who we are, but also that it is a problem of the racist. They have need to look down on someone. They have no self-esteem. And that's how I have come to a conclusion in my own mind. And so for me, I'm very happy, because I wasn't intending my book to come out at this time. In fact, I wasn't even thinking that it was going to be a book. You know, it was supposed to be a memoir for my son. So I'm glad that it came out at this moment, because I want everybody to know that Canada used to be a racist country. And what happened to us was approved by the government. The government and the politicians that encouraged it were racist. And we have to remember that in order to overcome this, we have to all individually, we have to be vigilant, that we cannot just pretend that it's not happening to individuals like yourself, or hide from it. Because, you know, when something like this happens, you don't want you don't even want to share it with people. I realized that the only way to overcome this is through vigilance, that each of us have the responsibility to speak out and to make sure that the government, pressure the government to do more, and the education system to do more. I really believe that the education system has a lot of responsibility, but unlike when I was young, when there were no Japanese Canadian or Asian Asians who were teachers, because professions were not allowed to people who didn't have the right to vote. Today there are many the people of different ethnicities teaching in classes, but the subject matter has to be well thought out so that the children learn what racism is about, and not just have to, a certain one of the children have to endure. That this is something that we all have to take responsibility for. So for me, I'm very happy that my book has come out at this time. And I hope that the young generations will read it and understand Canada's history. This, what happened to us was Canada's history at the time. And let's not make it into a history of today. You know, that it's not something that is continuing. Yeah. So I think
well. Thank you, Grace. I do have to disagree. You are very much a writer. I as a historian, having had the privilege to read your book, it's pretty mind-blowing. And I teach like first year level history courses. And History 102 is History of Canada Post-Confederacy. And I spend quite a bit of time talking about Japanese Canadian internments and stories around resilience and power through that narrative. You. You'd be surprised how many students are so shocked that they've never heard this story.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right? Exactly. And this is students coming out of a fairly new advanced curriculum design. So that means that it's still not being done at the level, like you say, and Larissa says, that there's still much work to be done around these stories.
Yeah.
But so grateful to you. Thank you, Grace.
Thank you.
Sarah, do you want me to repeat the question, Sarah? Yes. Okay. So can you address how much more meaning and purpose your publication has in light of the rise in anti-Asian hate and racism?
Yeah, I think something Larissa said that stood out to me was being able to show our full humanity and kind of our complicated lives and messiness. I think at a time where it feels like it's almost like scary to be Asian, or there's a lot of fear surrounding all of the rise in anti-Asian violence. And it feels like people spreading that violence is kind of sending this message of like, yeah, you should be afraid, like you should be scared. But, you know, being Asian isn't just something that puts us at risk of violence. It's something that brings us great joy. And I think that's really important to show in literature. In my book, Made in Korea, it's a young adult rom-com about two teens that sell Korean beauty products at school, and they go head to head to outsell each other. And the characters just have a lot of space in that book to be teenagers. They make mistakes, they fall in love, they grow, they laugh, you know, they are just complex human beings. And I think it's so important to have spaces where A, Asian people can feel safe in their full humanity, and B, where everyone can see Asian people in their full humanity. So I think that is really important, and what I feel like our books have to offer, especially in this time, because I think that the more space we make for those stories, the more space we take up. And I think we deserve to take up space.
It was interesting when I was reading your book, Sarah, I kept thinking that. I said, for the first time in a very long time, reading a book that would be, you know, perhaps part of a curriculum in high school, I'm only seeing a centeredness of, you know, Asian or even just Korean, Canadian or Korean identities. And I don't remember the last time I've read a book like that, like, and thinking back to my high school, you know, readings. And it was really powerful in that moment to say, like, your food references you make, your social, you know, cultural references, all was around the complexity of that identity. And I appreciated it so much. So you're absolutely right. The depths and layers of how you showcase identities through your writing is part of the solution. 100%. And I hope it'll be included in a curriculum down the road. I really hope so. Yeah. I'm going to go on to the next question and start off with Larissa again. The second question is more around our theme for today's panel. So is intersectionality, feminism, and power a pathway through which healing can be found? I think a lot of people are looking for healing, but also empowerment based on the harm that's been taking place across North America. So is intersectionality, feminism, and power a potential pathway for us to find that empowerment, those solutions? Larissa.
I had myself on mute there. Thank you, John. It's a good question and it's a big question. So I think I would like to start just by, you know, thinking about a little bit where the term intersectionality comes from. It's from an African-American sociologist called Kimberly Crenshaw, and she's thinking about the idea that some of us carry more than one oppression at the same time, right? But that the carrying of more than one oppression, it's not necessarily a compounding, it's its own sort of site that one inhabits, right? And that when, you know, initially, and I think this is still tends to be a tendency, when we're talking about race and racism, that, you know, when we're talking about racism against Asians, it tends to be Asian men, right, who get called to speak for. And then when we're talking about sexism, it tends to be white women who get called to speak for the position of womanhood. And so she's trying to call that out and say, you know, I, as in her case, as a Black woman, should be able and clearly have the experience of racism, have the experience of sexism, and have the experience of them in a compounded way. I think where the term intersectionality might fall a little bit short is it can tend to be a little bit ahistorical, and it can also tend to think about oppressions as one oppression as equivalent to the next. And so, you know, as we speak about it, I think it's also really important to recognize that the locations that each of us inhabits and those that members of our communities habit are always specific and historic and specific unto themselves. And this again is why like literary work is so important, right? Because it is, you know, as we were saying, Sarah was talking about it too, the place where a full complexity of being can unfold. And sometimes you might want to put the label Asian woman on it, for instance, but sometimes it might be more complicated than that, or it just might be about being human, right? Mm-hmm. Or it might be about being a prof or a cosmetic seller, right? Mm-hmm. But these things are all part of, you know, how any particular individual kind of walks through and moves through the world. And then another thing that I'd like to say in relation to intersectionalities, I think sometimes we use it when what we actually mean is something maybe more like relation or kinship. So we're trying to think about relationships through, between, and across racialized locations. So from Asian locations to Indigenous ones, for instance, that's not really intersectionality. That's more like relation, or trying to think about, you know, how kinships on these territories might have unfolded. So it's really important, I think, you know, when we're thinking about our terms, to think about what the freight that they're carrying. And then likewise, you know, with feminism, I think it's meant very different things for different people in different moments. For some people, you know, in some moments, you know, as Grace was saying, it's meant the right to vote or the right to enter the workplace. Sometimes it's meant the right to childcare, or it's meant reproductive rights, or the rights to be free from harm, to be free from sexual assault. So I think, you know, when I think of it as all of these things, I think of it as a term for sure through which it's possible to enact one's being as a woman, but also in relation to other women, self-defined women, so women who claim themselves to be women. So it's about relationships. It's about a capacity to take power, to take up space, to sort of fight against all of those structural impressions that come at us through the patriarchy primarily. But I think it also means specific things in relation to race and racialization. So, and different things, you know, from a Chinese Canadian location as opposed to a Japanese Canadian one, as opposed to a Korean Canadian one, as opposed to a South Asian Canadian, right? And so it's all of this sort of stuff we need to be thinking about together and putting into action together. And then likewise, power, you know, I think of that as a relation in the first instance, but for sure, you know, more popularly, we understand it as something to be taken, right? And for those of us who have, you know, traditionally been in places where we've been in the place of serving others, to take power, to take one's place in the society seems, you know, an important thing. I still feel like I do a lot of serving, but it's a different kind of serving maybe. And it's the kind of serving, some of it I don't want to do and I'm peed off about, some of it I'm more than happy to do. And, you know, and I'm happy and content to do. So stuff like, I think the work that I do with students, for instance, is a kind of serving, but I'm happy to do that. The kind of work that I do with community is a kind of serving, but I'm happy to do that. There's power, I suppose, in that kind of service. And then to think about healing as well, I think it is, you know, for those of us who come from locations and bodies upon which a lot of harm has been enacted, I understand why people may wish to heal. I wish to heal, but I also worry about it as a term a little bit because I guess, again, it can tend to sort of lift us away from the complicated histories in which we're also enmeshed, right? Mm-hmm. So as Asian people, we're also implicated in all kinds of, you know, in all kinds of abuses. I mean, in terms of even when we're doing stuff, right, for our own, you know, as Grace was talking about, you know, in relation to the uprooting, like the totally unjust uprooting of Japanese Canadians from the West Coast. Like it was a serious violence that the state enacted. But by the same token, the minute that JCs go to sort of fight for rights and restitution in response to that, they're reinforcing the state. And in reinforcing the state, we're continuing to perpetuate, right, land theft. Mm-hmm. So colonialism on Indigenous people than on the land. And then, you know, when we want to empower ourselves, for instance, by purchasing property, again, by embracing the property relation, right, we're taking away from Indigenous people's insistence on the sacredness of the land. Mm-hmm. So this is not to say that I don't think these terms are useful. I think all of the terms are really, really useful. It's important to take them up, and I have been empowered by them. And insofar as I'm healed, I'm not sure how healed I am, probably not very. it is through these terms that whatever I have has come to me. So I think they're important. Mm-hmm. But I also think we need to be careful not to just sort of wholeheartedly celebrate them and sort of hold them up as kind of like the ultimate channel through which we're going to get where we're going, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it absolutely does. Thank you, Larissa. I think you're also talking by pushing back against an ahistorical analysis of these words is to also look at evolution of the changes of how these words have been used and how they also change over time. Like, I think in terms of an Asian identity, many of us are challenging more our own communities and yes. anti-Blackness in our own communities. And, you know, like you said, very rightly, our role in, pushing Indigenous land rights further back so we're serving a colonial state. So you're 100% right. I think it's an evolution. And part of that healing is the questioning of the words, 100%. Sure. Thank you so much. Grace, I'm going to repeat the question again. So is intersectionality, feminism, and power a pathway through which healing can be found?
I found that a bit difficult for me to contend with because intersectionality was not something that was in my vocabulary throughout even into my adulthood. This is something that's come into my life only recently. And for me, feminism too is something that became more apparent in my adult life. Like, for instance, when I started working, I wasn't aware of feminism. In fact, I had to quit several jobs because of the need to get away from bully bosses. And the fact is, the men controlled your job. And so the sad thing I feel to this day is that I regret that I quit jobs. You know, in my later years, I argued it. You know, when I left the museum and, you know, other places, I did argue it before I left, but I still left because I didn't feel that I had the power to make a change. Even though I was in many instances older than the men that I was working with. And so for me, one thing that I want to share with the young people is don't quit. If you think you have a position that needs to be out there, then speak to it. And the trouble is, of course, that you quit because you have to move forward. You can't afford that time or the money, so it's an economic thing too. And I realize now that at my age, because I was much older, I should have fought each instance. But it was it wasn't just about Japanese Canadian. It was also about galleries working with a bureaucratic boss, that I had to contend with. And so I feel that, and at that time, as I say, we were not using feminism so much yet. And so we were not getting the support that we needed. Women were giving me support, but not openly. Mm-hmm. They would endanger their own jobs to speak out openly. So I didn't get that kind of support. The other thing, of course, is we're speaking right now about being Asian. I no longer say that. I am not an Asian. I am a Canadian. And I think that the word Asian is brought out too often about us. How are we Asian? We look Asian and our heritage is Asian, but our heritage today is Canadian. And I think we have to remember that we don't get mixed up in our who we are, that we speak from a Canadian mouth, Canadian head that experienced all these things in Canada. So I think it's very important not to group ourselves as Asians, but as if we say Asian, we have to make sure we say Asian Canadian. Mm. And but anyways, I just want to say too that for me, as I say, working in various places where major issue was sexism. And but in writing my memoir, I was not intending to write about sexism. But in the course of writing and rereading, I found that that aspect of my life became very large in the book. And so I had to recognize it, but I had to kind of rethink that. Mm-hmm. So that became part of my book. And having two sons, no daughters, and a husband through intermarriage, mm-hmm. It was very difficult for me to speak out about these things, but I wanted my sons to know, because my sons are not fools. They know, they know what I experienced, and also why I'm sharing this. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's very important for us to be honest about who we are, but also that speak out on issues of that, I'm really glad that we have the term feminism right now that I never had when I was younger. And I would like us to be more strong in how we live our lives. And I think that's what's happening now. I think more and more women are stepping forward to becoming very strong voices in our community. But I think that part of my book became very important to me. So I'm not sure if I haven't addressed the aspect of intersectionality, because that word was a bit foreign to me.
Sure, no problem. Yeah. I do have to say, Grace, there were a couple of moments in your book when you mention very bravely incidences of actual sexual harassment that you faced. Yes. And it's almost as though you're writing about it, you're coming to the realization that that is what happened. And I sensed that as well, like you were kind of going back, remembering as a 12-year-old, or you were very young when, much older man. So I found that very brave to see like your process of writing about it.
Well, I find it amazing that at my age, I didn't look for help. I recognized it as something that there was no help for from my parents, who were struggling without having to deal with issues that has to do with a young daughter being treated as such not only by another, maybe a Japanese Canadian boy, but also by a person of position in a city that I couldn't really fight, I knew that I couldn't fight against. Mm. Yeah. So, those things that started appearing in my memoir, which made me realize that my memoir was not just about racism, that there was much more to it than it's about a woman's life.
Yeah. Thank you, Grace. Sarah, do you want me to repeat the question?
I think I got it.
Okay.
About intersectionality, feminism, and power.
And healing.
Yeah.
Four words.
Very big words, I will say. Yeah. So I agree that it is a very broad, a lot of broad terms for sure, that each one I feel like has such complicated meanings and undertones, especially depending on the way that it's used and the topic that is being discussed. So I really appreciate kind of like the zoomed out historical look at the words, as well as the closer personal, like here's what it looked like in Grace's memoir. I think that was really interesting for me to listen to both perspectives. And for myself, I guess because the question is so large and the words itself are so large, I really kind of had to almost zoom it down to the most like individualistic level for me to kind of grapple with the question. So for me, how I interpreted it was intersectionality within one person's life. So as Grace mentioned, I think right at the end there, a story about a woman's life and kind of what I kind of branched off of that was like the crossroads that we meet as individuals in our own identity, whether that's our racial identity or sexual identity, gender identity, or what have you. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's so complicated even to talk about that in relationship with others. So I don't even know if my mind was like ready to go there for that question yet. It was just like, oh, like even within myself, like, how do you reconcile different parts of yourself that sometimes mm-hmm. feel at odds, or you don't know exactly how it fits, or, you know, that it seems like an oversimplification to just focus on one when you're such a complex human being. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure many people feel that way with their many different identities and how it crosses over and what perspective, what unique perspective that they have to offer from these intersections. Mm-hmm. And I think that it can offer healing in that perspective, mm-hmm. To acknowledge your different intersections or your different identities. I think it can offer healing because the more you embrace one part of yourself, I feel like it gives you permission to embrace other parts of yourself. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I've had conversations with people where they say, you know, the more I kind of embrace my identity as a Korean person, just as an example, mm-hmm. I feel like it led me to different parts of my identity that kind of opened up for me. Like the more comfortable I became with this part of myself, it allowed me that room to grow into this other part of myself. And I think that that's a really beautiful thing to see people become more wholly themselves by meeting themselves at their own crossroads, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of temptation sometimes when we come across a part of ourselves that feels dangerous or feels difficult to kind of shy away from it or to not know how to acknowledge it. But I think there's so much power to be found in wholly embracing oneself. And then kind of in a larger perspective, you know, on a more communal level, I do hope that the more we as individuals are able to do that for ourselves, the more we can do that for others and hold the space for other people in all of its complexities and difficulties as well. So definitely a huge question, but I think for me, the work really begins for myself and oneself.
Well, I think your answer is a great segue into the final question. And it's something, Larissa, all of you have touched on, is this idea of mentorship. And I think Larissa's point about the power of being able to give back to your community, that's something you decide and you kind of mold and craft. And so the last question really is about giving back and mentorship and power. So what role do you each see as mentorship in your roles as powerful women, authors, writers, community leaders? What is the role of mentorship? So Larissa, I'll let you start.
Sorry, I should have unmuted while you were still speaking. I think the mentorship is really, really important because it's through mentorship that we build community, right? Without having teachers. And I remember feeling that to be a really acute struggle when I was young, that there weren't that many older folks in the community, particularly who were doing work kind of oriented towards creative things, whether it was literary things or other kinds of art. So, I mean, I really value, you know, Grace in so many ways for that reason. I think I met you, Grace, and then in the 90s in there with Roy Meakey, probably at Powell Street Festival or something like that. And it was just so fantastic, you know, just to talk to you and to know what you were doing and to sort of understand or have a little bit of a sense of how your life had unfolded. And you were always so kind to me. And yeah, I really appreciate that. And I feel, you know, now is my moment pass that on. We're living in a strange moment right now. I mean, when I was in my 20s, there was a much stronger, it felt that way. I don't know if this is true. Grace probably would know the answer to this. That there was a bit more resources around kind of at the community level, partly because there was funding and stuff through things like the Canada Council, BC Arts Council and stuff like that to do the work. And it was possible to have this mentorship like in the communities, like in creative communities. I'm sure it's still true, but it just seems sort of less so. But that may be because I've gone inside. So, you know, as you were saying at the beginning, I'm working as a prof now at the University of Calgary. I was at UBC before that. And of course, I'm one of very few BIPOC, you know, queer BIPOC women teaching. And so a lot of the students, racialized students, queer students, women students, will come to me because they're looking for a reflection of themselves in their professor, as I was seeking at a similar age. So I've been working with them. I've also been working with other young folk who are just interested in poetry, especially experimental poetry, or interested in fiction, especially speculative fiction. I guess if there's one thing I think that's important I'm doing now, I'm running, I call it an UN-center. It's called the Insurgent Architects House for Creative Writing at the University of Calgary. And we regularly run events. I've done one on Asian Indigenous relation. We had another one called Black Lives Out West. There was one called Wisdom Council, where all of the speakers were, you know, people who had been my teachers or the generation of my teachers, to pass on those ways of knowing and ways of doing things that we used to have and that are moving and shifting. And I think that the younger generation doesn't know. They imagine that things have always been done the way we do them now, and that's not necessarily the case. So that one I felt was sort of extra special. And then just before COVID hit, and just by luck, I had begun a podcast series with some interviews recorded from the Wisdom Council symposium. But then beginning to do ones where students have been interviewing practicing writers, and been running them all as podcasts. So if anyone's interested, it's TIAHOUSE.ca.
TIAHOUSE?
TIA, so the Insurgent Architects, and then HOUSE,
House,
for, .ca.
Okay.
And you can hear them there. And I think that these podcasts are themselves acts of mentorship that on the one hand I've sort of built structurally into the structure of the project, but then it's also the writer being interviewed, mentoring the student who's interviewing sometimes. And other ones where, you know, the mentorship is going in both directions, where, you know, I've had like two writers of a similar generation interviewing one another. And then you have this wonderful kind of conversation that sort of within a community, but speaking about sort of specific lives and practices unfolding there. So, I mean, if there's something that I feel, you know, I wish we had more of, I wish we had more sort of 80s, 90s style community mentorship. I'm obviously really happy to have a position in a university and fortunate, and Grace says, don't quit. So Grace, I'll try not to. but I do sometimes feel that, you know, we're so managed and controlled by structures and forces within the institutions that make us do things in really awkward, not unproductive, but inelegant ways, when if we were just given the resources and a lot less sort of surrounding apparatus,
yeah,
we'd do it better ourselves. And I do think about that.
Do you think that's part structural racism, though, like systemic racism, because you're talking, right? Like,
It's part structural racism. And then more broadly, it's just, you know, university hierarchies that are, sure, structurally racist in part, but then they're also just hierarchical.
Yeah.
Getting back to your second question, you know, they're patriarchal, and then also the forms of accountability they demand. I mean, I do think we need to be accountable, but the forms of accountability can be quite awkward. So for instance, run through financial offices in the first instances, and then dean's offices, where the, you know, nothing against my dean, who is a lovely man, but it's the structure, like the structure itself, that sort of limits. Yeah. So it is partly structural racism, but it's other structures as well that are just as oppressive.
Sure.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Larissa. Grace, I'll repeat the second question. What role do you see mentorship in your roles as a powerful community leader? So what is the role of mentorship for you?
Well, I really enjoyed listening to Larissa. I think, considering that I'm about 50 years older or more, my life is at this moment is with a lot of younger people who are doing their PhD and all that. They are very kind, and they write to me, and and they call me their mentor and all that, which I think is a bit ridiculous because I look to them as my mentors. I find myself looking to them more as people who are knowledgeable and particularly about current things. So for me, though, I do look at it as a compliment, and I do try my best to give them what I know from my own past, and to share with them what I think may be of importance to them. But for me, I guess I think I've passed the age of mentorship, to be honest. But I really appreciate that mentorship is a very important thing because I never had that. The only mentor I had was my mother. And then with my mother was a very strong woman, but the thing about having mother as a mentor is that she was an immigrant, and she was also someone who had very strong Japanese culture, as her guide. And so, even though I didn't learn much about Japanese culture per se, I always thought of it as mother's culture. But I do know that she was the one who mentored me to become strong, that I don't just allow things to happen, that I have to speak out. In those days, my mother couldn't speak out outside of the home, but she was very open at home. She was very clear as to her position regarding society or regarding issues that were brewing outside. She would always be very confidently speaking at home as to what she thought. On the other hand, my father, I was very lucky to have a kind father, not a domineering father. So my mother was the stronger one in our family. So for me, as I say, I think that it was my mother's mentorship that made me, made my life that I have to lead, that I was able to lead that life and to do whatever I wanted to do, not have to depend on others. So I think that I should leave this up to the younger ones to speak on this, because I think I'm past mentorship.
I think you have a lot of mentoring that people still look to for you, Grace. Yeah, I think there's still a lot.
I really appreciate Larissa and that generation. And of course, she's talking about people like Roy Mickey. They were my mentors. Even though they were younger, they were my mentors, because they lived the lives, the kind of life that I wanted but didn't have, and learned a lot from that generation.
I do love the idea of mentorship that isn't barriered by age. Like, you can have mentors who are younger. Like, I've been influenced by younger people this year, right?
Yeah.
I think that's beautiful. Thank you, Grace. So I am cognizant of time. And if people are okay, we're going to go to about 1:10 to allow for a couple of questions that are in the chat box. So I'll let Sarah answer the last question, and then we'll go into the Q&A. So we'll go until about 1:10. Sarah, do you want to talk about what mentorship means to you?
Sure. I guess I'll talk about specifically in the writing sphere for me, like writing mentorship. And I feel like I have been very fortunate to have come across a lot of people who have been very giving of their time. And I think in this day and age, I've actually come across a lot of my mentors virtually. So I write for kids and teens. So I've kind of found like the kidlit community a lot in online spaces, which has been really great. So I've had a lot of great writers kind of be with me, especially in the early days of like querying literary agents when I was trying to sign with an agent for my project, and going on submission to editors at publishing houses. Like, I had a lot of great people that I could go to for questions and who have kind of been through the process themselves and were able to offer wisdom and support during that time. And still now, you know, as a debut author, I have a lot of writers who have been through it, who know the trajectory and know what the path kind of looks like. Generally speaking, it's different for everybody, but it's nice to have people who can understand and just offer a listening ear. And I think that it has been such a honor to have that kind of like one-on-one relationship with these writers. But I also see mentorship as people that you might never meet in real life, but through, you know, seeing their interviews or reading their books or seeing like how they compose themselves as authors or as people that you look up to, there is that kind of like from a distance mentorship in a way, like you're able to learn and grow from them without ever really having that conversation per se. So I think both are really important. One on kind of like a horizontal kind of like peer-to-peer kind of way. And then one, like even though they're far away, there's still so much to gain from seeing how they're living their life. And I think both have been really valuable for myself. And I hope that, you know, in turn that I can offer the same to others as well. I have, you know, in an official capacity, I've been involved in a mentorship program online called Pitch Wars. So if there's anyone listening who is interested in having a published author or agented author or whoever kind of look at your early work and, you know, walk you through that process of querying agents and whatnot, this is a good program to look into. It's quite large. So yeah, and it happens yearly. So it's kind of a good one to get plugged in. I had a really good time mentoring through that space. And I hope to do more things like that in the future. Maybe even like, you know, one day in-person things too. Like I love to connect with more people in person. But until then, you know, I hope that I would continue to be able to give back through online means and even from like a distance means as well. So in the same way that I received, I hope that I can give back, you know, tenfold to the community.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, well, what I'm going to do is just read out some of the questions and I won't ask anybody to answer. Feel free to jump in to whoever would like to answer the question. So the first question is, oh, they're just comments. I don't see questions. There we go. Okay. From Wiley, the question is, which book has served as your biggest mentor? So anybody can feel free to jump in. Which book has served as your biggest mentor?
I can answer this one. I think sure. So I actually do have like a few what I call like mentor texts. So books that I'll refer to, like if I'm writing a middle grade project, like books that inspire me. Like for example, I love Rebecca Steed writing or Steed, Rebecca. She wrote When You Reach Me is maybe her most well-known book. Her most recent book was The List of Things That Will Not Change. And I think that she is just such a like, reading her work is like a masterclass in middle grade voice. So whenever I'm writing a project for that age group, I often refer to her text to kind of refresh me on like, oh, what is it like to literally sound like an 11-year-old kid writing this book? So she would be one for me. Another is Pachinko by Minjin Lee is a big one, kind of seeing how she navigates like the generations of a Korean family and sharing like, the historical context of that. And then in the young adult space, I would say The Astonishing Color of After by Emily XR Pan is a big one for me. So I see these books as largely inspiring for my own work, both in terms of craft and in terms of their process for writing that they've shared.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Larissa or Grace? Larissa?
Sure. I think, you know, when I was younger, I mean, I was a huge, I'm still am actually a huge Angela Carter fan. I think I really learned from her how to be in the sort of myth and fairy tale aspects of one's culture and then take the forms of myth and fairy tale and turn them towards the contemporary moment or turn them towards my own concerns. So like the Bloody Chamber would probably be the one. I've been a huge fan of Dion Brand's work ever since forever. I think on the novel, What We All Long For, is really, really important for thinking about, you know, relationships specifically among Black and Asian young folks. I think it's that novel is set in the 80s or 90s, if I'm not mistaken, early-ish. And details the messy unfolding relationships among a group of friends of the same generation. So all sort of second generation kids carrying a lot of trauma, but trauma that's some of which is their own, but much more of which belongs to the previous generation, and they're kind of living it out in ways that they themselves don't fully, it's not that they don't fully understand, but it's inhabiting them and they're sort of playing it out in their lives. And that one is really beautiful. Dion's poetry as well, really, really amazing. Folks like Gloria Anzaldúa, you know, Adrienne Rich, Lee Maracle's work, really, really huge for having a sense of, you know, life unfolding on the West Coast. I learned a lot about just exactly what kind of place the Salish Sea is, or what we call British Columbia, right? That area. I think from reading her work and, you know, from having the good fortune to get to have the occasional conversation with her has been really, really important. Skylie's Disappearing Moon Cafe, for similar reasons, although I see Sharon Lee a lot less often. And then also the work of people like Roy Meakey, whom Grace was talking about earlier, as well as Roy Kiuka. So there's a beautiful book edited by Roy Meakey of Roy Kiuka's work called Pacific Windows, which is, you know, it's a compilation of Roy Kiuka's poetry and art and writing over the span of a career, in which he's experimenting like crazy with form, but without sort of leaving, you know, his own racialized body and experience behind. So there's a lot, thinking a lot about how to think about inhabiting a Japanese Canadian artist man body. That's also very, very beautiful.
Great. There are people asking for a list of some of the books mentioned. So maybe Larissa, if you can type it in our chat box, and perhaps there's a way the moderator can share it with the attendees. I'm wondering if I can go on to the next question. It was an important one, if that's okay. And maybe Grace, I can start with you to answer it. So the question was, how can we learn from intergroup anxiety and animosities among Asian ethnicities to address anti-Asian violence from non-Asians? So I'll repeat it. How can we learn from intergroup anxiety and tensions or animosities between Asian ethnicities? So Asian, there's many identities that fall within the broad category of Asian. So how can we learn from those anxieties and tensions in order to address the violence that's taking place broadly as anti-Asian violence?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because I think that each group is focused so much on their own problems that I think that there hasn't been enough interaction between Asian communities. And to be honest, in the old days, there used to be discriminations between them.
Yeah.
You know, that they've overcome more recently. But in the old days, like when I was young, there were still a lot of problems between Asian groups because of their history, you know, their history back home. So that was carried on. And so I think that it's only more recently that there's been more connection between these groups. And I think among the younger people, the other thing that I find very assuring that I'm very pleased about is the number of intermarriages between groups. And I'm always surprised when I hear that, oh yeah, her mother is Chinese and her father is Japanese, because in the old days that never happened. And now I'm finding that, and I think that is a good way learning to understand each other, but accepting each other. My own children are mixed, but also they're married and they're into more mix, and who knows? And I think that's one way of reaching out to each other. So I think it's very important. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, absolutely. No, you did, Grace.
I'm wondering if
that there's a lot to that.
Yeah, it's a very difficult question, but it's an important one. Larissa or Sarah, do you want to jump in to answer? Larissa?
I have a lot of thoughts about this one.
Yeah.
You know, that the question that is Ming Ming, is it? Yeah, that Ming Ming is asking. Mm. I felt plagued by this question from the very get-go. There were very, very earliest stages of my writing life. Mm. There's so much terrible infighting within our communities, like even within any particular quote-unquote identity category. And I'm not sure why it is. I mean, I would make some guesses. A sociologist could perhaps study this, but I think part of it is, you know, that for such a long time, because of that whole syndrome of one of each, right? You were talking, I can't remember who was saying this. I think maybe it was you, Sean, or it might have been Alan even before we.
I think it was the introductory video.
At the very start. You know, where the festival will only have like one Asian, one Black person, one Indigenous. So then when we suddenly find ourselves sort of in community with one another, it's really hard to not be kind of all caught up in that kind of competitive, you know, that competitive, I'm going to be the one that shines in the eye of the man. We're not necessarily even thinking in the eye of the man. It's just, I want to be the one that shines. I think that's what we think.
Mm.
And it happens beneath the level of consciousness. So I'm not saying anybody's doing this intentionally, but
right.
It's become such a sort of, it's such a kind of unconscious psychological habit for people who are marginalized, you know, in a white supremacist culture. And because we are also given no education and no tools as to how to be in relationship with one another. And then we have to find them for ourselves. Often when we're very, very young, we have like, there's nowhere to go for those tools because nobody has sorted it out. Like the older generations haven't sorted it out either. So, I mean, I think about this a lot in my work. My first novel, When Fox is 1,000, is an attempt to grapple with that problem. I don't know how successful it is, probably not very. But at least it's an attempt. And then this book as well, the more recent one, Iron Goddess of Mercy, again, is an attempt to grapple with that in part while sort of still dealing with, you know, with just basic old white colonial racism. You know, I mean, I think that there are certain basic things that some of us have figured out to a certain extent, but there's still so much work to do. So, you know, if Ming Ming is looking for advice, I mean, I would say part of it is, you know, just to be sort of self-reflexive and be attentive to those moments when those feelings of competitiveness arise in yourself. Price culture doesn't help, right? But when those feelings arise in yourself, and then try not to do it to the other person, right? And that's probably the place to start. It's like, oh yeah, I am actually kind of feeling a bit competitive towards Rita or whoever, somebody I love dearly. You know, I could like snap at her and put her down, but how about if I don't, right? Because we can only be responsible for, you know, our own behaviors and our own, you know, actions towards others. And I think it's perfectly understandable to have these feelings about one another. Like, of course, because that it's structural racism, Sean, at work there. So it's perfectly understandable to have these feelings, but it doesn't mean we need to act on them. And I think the more conscious we can be about having them and, you know, accepting them as sort of part of our being, right? Like it's human to feel competitive, but then that doesn't mean that I have to be mean to the person that I'm jealous of. I can be jealous. It's okay to be jealous. It doesn't mean I have to be unkind to that person. And that might be a simple first step. It doesn't stop there, obviously. And I think there's so much further to go. But I also think we're not helpless. We have tools to deal with these dynamics. I mean, and especially, you know, this millennial generation, which I feel like is so much more, Grace was saying she learns from younger people. I feel like the generation, you know, younger than me is so much more attuned to these kinds of things than my generation was. Like, I mean, I hope it's partly to the credit of, you know, your boomer and Gen X parents. But we do have more tools than we had in previous generations to begin to think about these problems. So I think even that Ming Ming is asking the question is really fantastic.
I saw somebody say something really powerful, and they said, you know, I don't want to force myself to be white adjacent. I want to be liberated. I want to seek liberation. And that blew my mind, because I think so much of
writing and or academia or wherever we are, we're trying to back to the box you were saying we are forced to squeeze into uncomfortably, say in the university sector. It's forcing us into kind of this white adjacent space, like we're somehow wanting to achieve the power of whiteness. Right. And it's not about that, it's our own liberation.
Exactly.
It's our own liberation through the complexities of our identities. And I think Grace spoke to that and Sarah did and Larissa. There was beautiful comments in the question and answer. I hope you all got a chance to see that. We are over time, but I just want to end by saying how important this conversation was today. I could keep talking to you three for hours. Like, you're just brilliant, all three of you. But thank you so much for your work. I'm going to quickly plug the books for the attendees. So if you can see this, this is Falling Cherry Blossoms by Grace, Iron Goddess of Mercy by Larissa, The Tiger Flu by Larissa, and Made in Korea by Sarah. I encourage people to please read them. They're amazing books of poetry, novels, biographical, historical writing. And all three of you are so amazing. And I wish you all the best in your journeys. And thank you to the attendees.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Sarah. Bye, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Bye.
Start living, start listening, from features through music to news, reflecting your views. This is
CYVR's thing.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Vancouver, UBC.
Accelerated program.
Accelerated programming since 1937.
It's great!